Red Dice Diaries podcast, a rambling journey through the wonderful world of RPGs by a longtime GM and player. The music at the start of this podcast is Shinigami by Tarek, used under Creative Commons license. I'm joined by Wit, Johannes, Matthew and John Drury, and we're going to talk a little bit about cyberpunk. Now, I've got to confess that I don't particularly have a massive experience of cyberpunk in terms of role-playing, although I enjoy quite a lot of the fiction and the sort of TV shows and the films, etc. So I'm relying on you guys to lead me through, because I've generally found that like the cyberpunk RPGs that I've read haven't particularly like scratched the sort of like the bits of the genre that I particularly like. But I think first of all, it's probably important to reach some sort of consensus about what we actually think cyberpunk is as a genre, just to make sure we're not all talking at cross purposes and we're all talking about different things. So shockingly, I've done a little bit of research for this. Now, if you Google cyberpunk, the definition it gives you is a genre of science fiction set in a lawless subculture of an oppressive society dominated by technology.
I think it's spot on as a generic definition for what the genre generally represents.
I think it's missing the sort of, it's a futuristic technology. It's more futuristic and most common.
It does say specifically by computer technology, so it does give us that. But that has a wide spectrum. Obviously, the computer technology they were predicting in when the genre was first born, we have now. So now the new cyberpunks would have to be even more futuristic.
We have a lot of stuff that they never thought would happen. Like, this is a thing that gets asked about all the time. Like, why? Like, you wrote the Neuromancer, Gibson. You're the daddy, the granddaddy of cyberpunk. Why didn't you put cell phones in there? And he's constantly like, I didn't guess that.
I'm just a man.
There's also a certain element of transhumanism. I think that the first parts of that began in the cyberpunk genre. People were enhancing themselves. And I think even Neuromancer, they talked about techno shock, where it's a little bit too, humanity can't quite handle the changes as they're happening.
Absolutely.
I think that's a big part of cyberpunk as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue, well, with a lot of different genres, but certainly with sci-fi in particular, is obviously there's lots of different subgenres of sci-fi, but you tend to get quite a bit of like bleed in between them. So if you say, just as an example, if you say, for instance, like cyberpunk is about incorporating technology sort of into the human body, into the human person, we also see a lot of other sci-fi genres where there's people with like bionic limbs even if you like look at things like Star Wars, there's obviously like mechanical hands, there's the administrators who have like they have like the computers that are attached to their brains. Exactly, Vader. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of bleed between the different subgenres, and that can make it sort of a little bit difficult to define. But wait, you're like the cyberpunk guy, if you'll forgive me for calling you that. So if someone was to ask you to like put you on the spot like I'm doing now and say like, right, what's cyberpunk to you, what would you say?
I think definitely the description we've heard so far is pretty much right on the money. It's definitely, there are certain elements that I think, if you took the big Venn diagram of sci-fi and the elements that influence cyberpunk, noir is a huge, huge part of it, obviously. That's where you get all those kind of, you know, like Blade Runner detectives, and you know, it's very, very dark, and there's always shadows, and it's always raining. And you have the probably like the Orwellian 1984 kind of revolutionary going up against the big organizations, big governments, big corporations. And I think the kind of transhumanism, that sort of like enhancing yourself and where does humanity go from here question, is also another big part of that. And I think it all kind of blends into one to sort of form this little kind of sci-fi changed from that kind of post-war futurism to, you know, going and seeing planets and meeting alien races and those old sort of four-colour covers with green women and all that kind of stuff. And I think we sort of got to a point that it sort of changed and people wanted something that was a little bit more politically aware and a little bit more revolutionary. I think the revolutionary part, I guess cyberpunk, is a huge part of that as well. So, I think I've covered everything.
Yeah, I mean, obviously... So in terms of like RPGs, like Cyberpunk 2020 is one of the sort of like, if you want to call it the forerunners, or one of the sort of
big names in that.
The old school.
Yeah, the old school name, if you prefer. Now, I know that was inspired a lot by the novel Hardwired by Walter Williams, which I have read like years and years ago. And if I remember correctly, for that involved a lot of these sort of these government organizations which seemingly controlled like every facet of existence, and it was about a couple of people, like a hired gun and someone who was more involved with like the tech, sort of like teaming up to try and escape from a planet and escape from the sort of leash that those like megacorps, if you want to call it that, had sort of slipped around society and that control. So I think for me it's always been about sort of taking that idea of that noir sort of aesthetic, but sort of wrapping it up in like a sort of futuristic wrapper and incorporating these ideas of like technology and corporations getting out of control. And basically one of the things I always like about it is the sort of theme of how much personal control do we actually have over ourselves and society. And for me, I've never really found an RPG that sort of portrayed that in a satisfactory way for me. So to throw it open to you guys, in terms of like your sort of experience, if you have any of cyberpunk RPGs, have there been any particular games that you thought have portrayed the sort of the cyberpunk aesthetic and ethos particularly well?
Well, for me, I don't have a ton of experience with the RPG side of it. It's mostly with Shadowrun. Personally speaking, in terms of a setting, I think Shadowrun is obviously a mix of both a cyberpunk and an urban fantasy. So for me, it hits the nail on the head of one of the elements I like most about cyberpunk, which tends to be that sort of a noirish, oppressive feeling that you tend to get in it. The technology is ubiquitous, the magic is ubiquitous. Everybody is on a nice edge, even from the, you know, the dragons of the setting all the way down to the street scum, you know. So it to me, I thought they did a really good job of embodying it. That was my son saying hello to everyone, by the way.
Cyberpunk is, when I was in that kind of 11 years old, I kind of like dragons, role-playing. This is all good. When Cyberpunk came out, it was absolutely mind-blowing for me, because it was kind of like, wow, this is all about the books that I like. The reason I think Cyberpunk has been a classic, and through all the different iterations has been popular, is the sort of the character archetypes, the roles in Cyberpunk kind of like definitely cover all of the bases of like the classic Cyberpunk kind of protagonists. You've got Solos, which are basically like Case and Molly from Neuromancer. You've got the Medias, which is like Edison Carter from Max Headroom, 20 Minutes Into the Future, all that kind of stuff. You've got Rocker Boys, you know, why not? You've got the techie guys, and then of course you've got the hackers, which are fairly ubiquitous in Cyberpunk all over the place. And Cyberpunk was one of those games that, while their home background was fairly generic, and it was good, you know, I've stormed Arasaka many, many times myself. There's definitely, I think, the work that they did in kind of like covering all the different aspects of Cyberpunk genre was very, very good. As systems go, it's, yeah, you know, Cyberpunk is great, but it definitely seemed to sort of boil down into, I think there's two sort of genres of Cyberpunk. One is that kind of low level, down and dirty, do I buy food or ammunition kind of thing. The man's on my tail, we've got no resources and we have to get out of here kind of thing. And then it also, there's that kind of glamour top level, we're dealing with the corporations, we've got an infinite amount of money, we've got loads of cool toys, we've enhanced ourselves, we've got giant transforming robot cars and all that kind of stuff. You're basically just a futuristic James Bond. Some games kind of focus on that level, some games are better on the lower level, and I think there's a load of games that do the aspects of Cyberpunk very, very well. Slay Industries, for example, is really, really good. There's no cyber in it. It's all biological enhancement, but there's a huge corporation that basically controls the universe. You have to work for them. You basically have to do missions, and part of what you're doing is becoming popular and becoming better and famous in that realm in order to kind of... So you're part of the system whilst you're trying to, be a revolutionary within it. And I think that's done very, very well in Slay Industries.
Well, I was actually going to just jump on something that that I think that we've both talked about so far, Mark, but... you know, we both talked about how certain games have done like, oh, theme really well, setting really well. But I think, and that's another something that we all talked about a bit prior to the call and in preparation for the call, was how a lot of these game role-playing games get the role-playing aspects down right. You feel like you're, you know, on the street. You feel like you're in this glamorous corporation, whatever. But when it gets down to then having to roll the dice or using mechanics, I don't know, I have the same problem, and John and I think we agree on this, is that a lot of these games just are very dense mechanically, and they're so concerned with modeling. Like Shadowrun is very guilty of this. Like I love the setting, but I would never use the actual Shadowrun mechanics to run it. I'd use Anarchy, or I try to just do it with Fate or something like that, because for me, I just want to involve myself in that world, in that setting, that theme. I want a mechanical system that allows me to do that very smoothly and quickly, not here's the tome of the mechanics. I totally agree.
Cyberpunk is 2020 kind of always devolves into go first, shoot people in the face.
Yeah. And it's like, how do we, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, if you are familiar with the genre well enough, or you just love those themes, you can do it with any system. But I think the problem that I think turns away a lot of potentially new players to the genre, like Shadowrun, for example, or Cyberpunk, both of them should be like easy sells. But like when you then open the books up and start trying to explain it to the people, it's like, well, do you got 3 hours of your time to just go through this? And then people are just like, I'm out. I you know, I'll go play D&D because I already know it, or I'll play Fate because it's very simple. Or do we have any examples that are, because obviously like Shadowrun Anarchy is a good example of this, where it was an attempt to create a version of Shadowrun that was accessible. And that's a great example. But like, I don't think there are any actual examples of a full-fledged, you know, prime product that is not like that in Cyberpunk. So, and you would know more, you guys. So that's why I'm asking the question.
Like, in terms of like games, I've got that, I think, are sort of Cyberpunk RPGs. The only ones I've really got is I've got that. Mm-hmm. And I've randomly got like a copy of like Shadowrun 4th edition.
Yeah,
and don't talk about Barbie Punk.
And I mean, I've only really got I've also got Interface Zero for Fate. For me, a lot of
Interface gets it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of games focus a lot on the kit, mm-hmm. and the sort of gear that you're going to get. I mean, even like Interface Zero, which is based on Fate, which is a game that is not focused on kit. The game shifts dramatically in that direction, and it doesn't make it necessarily a bad game. It shifts the focus dramatically from the main focus of the system. Now, for me, obviously technology is a huge part of the Cyberpunk ethos, as we said. But for me, like the main interesting thing about the settings isn't the kit. It's like I don't pick up like some Cyberpunk fiction and immediately start thinking like, oh, look at all this like cool gear they've got and like this equipment. Yeah. Whereas I find a lot of, certainly though, the RPGs I've read, they focus a lot on those kit, on the kit, and buying equipment's always been one of like the least interesting bits of RPGs for me.
The word. Part of this is to like relates to the fact that a lot of Cyberpunk stuff revolves around these mega corporations, right? And like the fact that they dominate your entire lives with their product lines is a big thing, right? It's a theme. Like you're not just using a cyber deck, you're using the fucking Silverlight Excalibur 3000 or whatever. And like that's a thing inside the setting.
Yeah, it's true.
I just think that it can be portrayed then in terms of theme, like, oh, okay, here's a section of the book that talks about these are like the three big corporations, and then these are their major products, and you will find yourself using one or all of these products in your daily life, and you have no choice. And to really talk about how that affects people in that world, I don't know, I don't need to know the stats on the gun or how well that deck makes me hack, because I know that's what it's going to let me do. I mean, that's why we have those things. You know, I'd rather read like a chapter that's all about and the Silverlight deck versus the Hatari deck. You know, why that is an important clash. Or, hey, you know, you drove that sky car yesterday, but really you don't own it. You're only renting it through your, you know, slave wages or whatever. You know, it's like stuff like that is the appeal of aspects like that in a Cyberpunk setting, not as a player in a game sitting there and being like 40 pages of gear just to write down my initial character stat line. I'm just like, get me out of here.
Yeah, I think when Cyberpunk started, we were sort of in that age of slightly more simulationist role-playing games. We also had Cyberpunk, well, it was then 2016, but obviously became 2020 eventually. Cyberspace, which was a game by Iron Crown Enterprises, which was like a cut-down Rollmaster, like Merc, but reskinned to Cyberpunk. And if you could ever think of a game that wouldn't fit in the Cyberpunk genre. It's Merv. And I think over time what's happened is we've kind of discovered that role-playing, the fun part of role-playing isn't necessarily the numbers and adding all the things and going shopping, but it's kind of like the cool things that you can do with your characters and the sort of more narrative kind of games that happened more recently. And I'm a fairly recent convert to this stuff. I was a beardy, you know, I like my dice, I like my numbers, and I like my books and guns and all that kind of stuff. I kind of got taken in by Power by the Apocalypse, and there's a couple of really, really good games now that would be my preferred way of doing
Cyberpunk. I thought that's what you were talking about, Johannes.
James Cameron's The Sprawl, which immediately, when I was going to conventions, I would always have a copy of The Sprawl in my bag, because you can just run it straight away. You can basically just make a session. Everyone gets a book. Everyone gets their little character sheets. You make up the corporations as you go, and you can just run a game of Cyberpunk off the cuff. And that is absolutely incredible, because it means you don't have to carry all this stuff. And it's a fairly good way of doing it. It's very evocative. And I love the fact that the those little, the little character sheets.
Playbooks.
You open up the playbooks and you basically go, pick one of these three things. And they are very, very iconic, you know, evocative of the background. The whole game, it's pure Cyberpunk, start to finish. And there's absolutely no prep. Awesome.
Yeah, and it's like hyper distilled as well. The Sprawl is, I mean, it's not your like generic, this is a Cyberpunk game and you pick whatever you want and you do whatever you want. No, The Sprawl is, you are people who can't have real jobs ever in this world. You are outside of the system forever, unless you want to retire a character, because that's not what the game is about. The game is about you being on the streets and running missions like Shadowrun style, and it's really aggressively designed for that. It's it has phases, like you do your legwork before the mission, and like you get the mission, and then you do your legwork, and then you complete the mission, and then you have the wrap-up, where probably whoever hired you is trying to fuck you, because that's how it goes. But then you do
the corporations don't really like little people. Who knew?
Yeah, turns out they don't care about you.
Yeah.
And also, every single positive that you get from the character's generation, you have to have some kind of story negative attached to it.
Yeah.
I've got to admit, The Sprawl is probably one of like the few sort of like bigger, like for argument's sake, Power by the Apocalypse games that I don't actually have like a hard copy of. So I remember speaking to you about it to Games on Demand with like the UK Games Expo. It is actually like one I want to pick up myself, because I do think for like conventions and stuff, like Power by the Apocalypse is almost like made for those sort of like those rapid like one-off sessions.
They are great like that, because it's like as Johannes and Mark were saying, they tend all their game lines, because I'm a big fan of Urban Shadows and Monster of the Week, which are two books that use that system, and they're very much like, this is what you are, this is what you're doing. Like, you'll have like the archetypes or whatever genre it's supposed to be. The whole game, the way they build them, each of these books, they always tend to be ground up. This is the genre, this is the flair, this is the flavor, and it's all feeding together. And that's one of the strengths of Power by Apocalypse, which is the reason why I've never actually completed a Power by Apocalypse game, because keep trying to do it by play-by-post and it falls apart, because you gotta have people that are like on board, like, no, we are here to play Urban Shadows, we're here to be monsters and maniacs, or hey, we're here to play The Sprawl, we are all street scum trying to get our last credit to get the ticket out of town. You know, it doesn't lend itself well to, I don't know as much with play-by-post maybe, but around the table they're very powerful, because they're just all driven towards the goal, whatever the system is. And so I do have The Sprawl, by the way, guys. So I haven't read that one yet. I have to finish reading it. I'll definitely check that one out a little bit more deeply after this call, I think.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. There's also, in a similar space, there's a game called The Veil, another Power by the Apocalypse game that kind of is a little bit more, stretches Cyberpunk to the limits. So if you want to be kind of like a little girl with a giant robot, that kind of stuff, the sort of slightly more
esoteric
sci-fi or anime manga element.
See, I kind of like that flair. And I think that Cyberpunk matched with anime, they do it quite frequently, and it works out usually really pretty well, obviously. Mm. I could quote Ghost in the Machine. That would be sort of a little bit banal of me, because everyone knows Ghost in the Machine. But just in general, I think that they mash the ideas well together.
Yeah, I think a lot of Cyberpunk comes from that. At that time that Cyberpunk was hitting, a lot of stuff came over from Japan. So like, right, things like Akira and Ghost in the Shell.
Yes.
I mean, I do wonder as well if like part of the reason that there's not so many sort of like full bore, like 100% Cyberpunk RPGs nowadays, for argument's sake, is because we see a lot of non sort of Cyberpunk RPGs incorporate what I consider to be like cyberpunk elements into them now. I mean, certainly most as technology in the real world's moving on, it's becoming part of our everyday life. I think back when Cyberpunk, the RPG, like Cyberpunk 2020 or whatever, was, or Cyberpunk 2016 as it was released, it was more of a sort of an unusual thing to like consider, like, oh, that technology might have such a great impact on our everyday lives. Whereas I don't think now we don't see it as so much of a stretch, because they say like things like going like, oh yeah, you can like use your like deck to like log onto computer systems like from the middle of a street or from the back of a van or whatever. Like, I think when sort of Cyberpunk first came out, I was like, oh, that's some like far future like unrealistic like bullshit going on down there. Whereas now if you're like, oh, like someone like sitting in a coffee shop or sitting in the back of a car logging on with a phone, yeah, exactly, that's like not even a thing now. That just is part of everyday life. So I wonder if like the people who are trying to make sort of cyberpunk RPGs, they have to like stretch that even further now, because like our definition of what's become like futuristic technology has moved on.
Yeah. Can I ask a follow-up question then, John, because that's certainly what I was thinking of pretty much, is like, why, with, cause I think Cyberpunk has one of the most interesting aesthetics.
Absolutely.
Of all the kind of genres out there. Like, it's a really interesting place to exist in, and I always wonder, why isn't it more popular, why isn't it more in the current sort of pop culture eye than it used to be?
Well,
I was thinking, is that more so because no one's managed to blend the elements together in a way that's really resonated in modern day, or is it because Cyberpunk, like you were saying, John, is a product of its time, and like now it's that now the technology looks more like a retro futuristic rather than actual futuristic when it was made?
Well, I think part of the thing now is you do see a lot of sort of cyberpunk elements in RPGs, but it's not necessarily RPGs that are fully based around that idea. I mean, to go back to what we're saying about sort of like bionic implants and stuff like that, you'll be unlikely to find any sort of sci-fi RPG that doesn't have sort of cybernetic implants of some degree in them, whether it's like space opera, harder sci-fi, whatever. But these games don't really have that whole sort of cyberpunk ethos, you know, the big corporations, the restrictions on personal liberty, stuff like that that you tend to see in the sort of like darker sort of cyberpunk setting, if you will.
Yeah, and I think a lot of cyberpunk was kind of, well, didn't quite hit in a huge way necessarily, as far as, you know, obviously we have our favorite films and stuff like that, but they didn't quite go, you know, Blade Runner was absolutely tanked when it first came out, that kind of thing. But I think that aesthetic had got co-opted quite a lot for various other little kind of projects. You look at, there's some films, things like video games, that cyberpunk aesthetic got stolen for things like Deus Ex, for example, that's been going for years. It's a great example of the genre. You'd have a character that you upgrade all the time with your, you know, cybernetic limbs and eyes and all that kind of stuff. But it never really kind of, there isn't really a sort of definitive high budget revolutionary film. Blade Runner was a sleeper hit for a long time. We finally got a sequel, which is incredible. Blade Runner is pretty sober.
No, it's analog.
Yeah, but Blade Runner is in the, like, if you had a spectrum of, like, all things that people have called cyberpunk throughout the ages, like, Blade Runner is firmly, in my opinion, at least, it's a noir film with some sci-fi on top. Like, it's
on the edge of that Venn diagram I spoke about earlier. But
yeah. It's a noir film set in the future. Yeah,
the visual aesthetic for that dark future is perfect, and I think what happens is, like now, like you were saying earlier, it's kind of like the technology has advanced, but cyberpunk games maybe haven't necessarily. I remember the first cyberpunk, it's kind of like, oh, you have a cyberdeck that has 10 megabytes of memory.
Yeah.
And back then, that was ridiculous.
While the idea of cyberpunk is quite elastic, because obviously it's a certain sort of world with ubiquitous computer technology, that could be any of a number of 100 different ideas or settings, right? But are we of perhaps of the mind now, though, that as we have caught up technologically with the eras that cyberpunk were written for or in or about, like, because obviously we're forward-looking. Now, when we forward look, we're looking at, you know, rocket punk, we're looking at transhumanism, we're looking at these other genres that have sort of kind of re-emerged or re-evolved, and now they're the ones that are forward-looking. So is it a sense that the cyberpunk as it was written has been supplanted by these other genres or these other ideas coming in for now more? Or is it just simply that maybe we need to see a new evolution of cyberpunk. Like, so what's the next epoch of computer technology going to look like? Quantum computing, all those other sorts of things, like stuff that we're theorizing about today or thinking about today. You know, are the writers of today going to be writing about that? Or are they going to simply be writing about all of us living in a singularity, you know, on a rocket ship flying, tumbling through space, you know, because that's where it is now. Like, that's what's in vogue right now in terms of sci-fi.
You know? I mean, just to jump in there, I see we've got Lloyd in the Twitch chat, and he's saying that the change in, like, just in the hacking world from third edition Shadowrun to, like, fourth edition was incredible, and it went from all, like, your wired decks, we had to, like, plug them in to, like, access a network, into, like, yes, cloud computing. And he's saying
exactly what I'm hitting on. Yeah,
yeah. He's saying as well, like, he's mentioned, as we have done, that
it needs to keep evolving if it's going to be an extant genre and not be subsumed by these other newer genres or these genres that have come to the fore now, because otherwise it's just going to seem very old-fashioned. Like if you go back and watch the original Star Trek, hell, if you go back and even watch Next Gen, it seems a little bit dated with the technology because we have all that stuff and some of that stuff and better now, you know?
We, like, have iPads now.
That's it. Exactly it, you know? Their touchpads and Next Gen look like shit compared to ours, you know?
Yeah. Lloyd has recommended a Fate game called Uprising for a game that's, he says it sums up what he thinks new cyberpunk is. Like, I can't claim to know anything about Uprising, to be honest. Yeah. Lloyd described it as exemplarizing that whole, like, you versus the man sort of, like, philosophy.
Right.
Yeah, I think, like, generally, well, the traditional cyberpunk suffers from the same deal, as I said in chat, as does Vampire. Like, it was a product of his time, I feel. And I think it's very challenging to make new cyberpunk games that, like, push the genre forward in a world where Eclipse Phase exists.
Like, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Like,
exactly.
You're miles behind already when you start.
but I would argue, though, that Eclipse Phase is not cyberpunk. It's more transhumanistic biopunk.
Yeah,
entirely.
And so they feel, I mean, obviously they have similar, you know, things. You got corporations and governments and all that. But you can say that about any piece of fiction that, oh, they're going to have similarities, right? Mm-hmm. For me, when I look at Eclipse Phase and I read like Altered Carbon versus Neuromancer, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, I see the similarities. I see the pedigrees, where they all arrive from. But I can see the massive differences that, narratively speaking, creatively speaking, the choices that the writers had to make it feel like two distinct animals. So
yeah.
I totally agree with what you're saying there, Johannes. That's what I'm saying. It's like, in a world where Eclipse Phase exists, how do you compete? You can, but it's by looking at what you got in the pedigree of a cyberpunk, and then really, well, yeah, exactly, like the spoil that you keep pumping, thank you very much. But it's like, no, how do you put, you got to push it forward along its trajectory and then take it to that next level. And it can be done, but it hasn't been done. I mean, obviously, you're saying the scroll has done it. Well, I mean, I got to go read this scroll tonight is what I'm going
to
do.
In terms of, like, imagining what future technology is going to be like, we only have to, like, look at how difficult that it is to make any sort of accurate predictions about that. I mean, if you look at, like, the old sort of, like, Jules Verne stuff where they're talking about sort of, like, rocket ships going to the moon and stuff like that, all of that seems, like, ridiculous now. But at the time, based on the technology they had, that must have at least seemed somewhat plausible, albeit futuristic. Whereas we know that often, like, technology, although it fills a particular niche, it goes in ways that we wouldn't expect or we wouldn't predict. So I think it would be difficult to make, like, a new game. I mean, Wit, for instance, just, like, for argument's sake, if you were going to be, like, making, like, a new sort of, like, cyberpunk game.
I just happened to be writing and developing a cyberpunk
role-playing
game.
Yeah, hypothetically, if you were doing that, I mean, how would you sort of, like, go about it? How would you sort of try and predict the future?
Yeah, it is a challenge. And I don't think it's necessarily about predicting the future. I think the way that new creative endeavours happen is everything is a remix of what's come before. Part of why I started putting my game Black Code, remember that?
I looked for it.
Thanks. It's not out yet.
Don't backed worry. Already.
While I put that together was because I was a little bit dissatisfied with what cyberpunk, you know, I got fed up of running CP 2020. I couldn't run another game using that system, and I needed something that would enable people. I think empowering characters is very, very important in a role-playing game. And if you've got certain archetypes in cyberpunk, now, over the last sort of 20 years or so, since, you know, Neuromancer all the way up to what we have now, like, you know, the Ghost in the Shell film and Altered Carbon, there's such a huge variety of different characters and enhancements and the kind of thing that people will look at and say, well, if it's cyberpunk, you need to be able to do this. You need to have this. You need to have X. You need to have this kind of character. So writing a game that means that characters are empowered and they can kind of be whichever cyberpunk archetypes that they like, I think is very important. It kind of works, things like The Sprawl and Powered by the Apocalypse works because, and even Fate to some extent, because you have that aspect. You can make that whatever you like. And if you can have something that you can skin the game mechanic part of it to what you want to describe and how it works, that means that characters can be, you know, players can make whatever characters they like and they can kind of, you know, if they want a cool jacket that gives them a plus one, they've got a cool jacket that gives them a plus one, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting point you're making about the potential, like, expandability and, like, the sort of broadness of a setting. So, I mean, one of the things that's always appealed to me as a GM for, like, potentially more traditional RPGs that you need is the fact that you've got that game system, then you can create your own world, your own campaign world that you explore with that game system. Whereas certainly more traditional, so arguably traditional, so they're all very much sort of like in a sort of, for argument's sake, like a grimy version of the real world, which to me doesn't seem to have, apart from the technology and how that's affected things, doesn't seem to have as much versatility for me as a GM. It's like to use Vampire, as that Johannes was talking about, if you're running Vampire, it's by and large our world. There's differences, but it's our world. Whereas if I sit down and go, right, I want to create a world for like a fantasy game, I can do pretty much whatever I want. Whereas if I sit down to play like a Vampire or like a sort of Shadowrun game, I'm like, right, it's the real world. And that sort of limits your choices a little bit as a GM, which I think for me is why I tend to prefer sort of a bit more traditional sort of sci-fi or the space opera stuff, because it lets you get out there and sort of, you can set it on an alien world, you can set it in like a different place where everything's different to our world, as it
but
is.
At least with something like Shadowrun or also not in the same genre, but or something like Numenera, where it's set in our world, but both of those settings, like Shadowrun for example, you might have a place that might still be called New York City, might vaguely resemble New York City in some ways. It ain't New York City though. It ain't, you know, there's no orcs walking down the streets in New York, I can tell you for a fact. So it's interesting because I think that Shadowrun is actually a good example of how you can liberate an our world setting versus say something like Vampire. Because Vampire, unfortunately, as much as I love Vampire the Masquerade as a setting, because it is dealing with subversive history and things and walking in the shadows, and I love that as a theme, but it is sort of like you can't necessarily have a vampire god break out and start destroying half the subcontinent of India and make it make sense. Because at the end of the day, it still has to be in our world, quote unquote. So like when you don't embrace the alternate world concept enough, it, like you said, John, it comes very staid. And I think that's a killer for a genre like cyberpunk, where if it feels too much like our world, or is our world 20 years from now, suddenly it's like, okay, but what's the flavor? What's the thing that I can really like latch onto as being different, you know?
Yeah, I mean, to put you on the spot a bit again, Whit, in terms of your game, like Black Code, which I've heard you talk about, what is the, how would you give us like the capsule sort of like description of the setting of Black Code?
So, one of the things that I wanted to do, because when I make games, is I needed to make sure that it had like a very, very deep world. So it's kind of like there's been a global tragedy, a global apocalypse, and it's set in the last city. It's a very, very big city, but it's the last city, called Darwin. After the nanite apocalypse, after the Grey Goo apocalypse, basically. And all the characters play what are called contractors, effectively hired professionals that have to make their way dealing with the various different corporations or corplexes, as they're called in Black Code. Within the city, there are three arcology corplexes, which are kind of like transhuman societies that have their own self-contained areas, in which case they have kind of control over. So there's the grid, which is basically just like your traditional cyberpunk. It's a giant sort of megaplex of a city with many, many levels, and they basically still cling to the great god consumerism, which is in itself a cyberpunk trope. Most of the people there are hybrids, which means they basically are humans that have mechanical enhancements and cyborgs, also biological enhancements in order to kind of make themselves good. So if you wanted to just play your traditional cyberpunk in Black Code, just set all your adventures in the grid. There's also the Temple, which is a transhuman society that believes that technology is holy, and the way that humanity can advance is to upload themselves into a mechanical frame and basically become robots and eventually earn their way into Eden, which is their virtual heaven. And people believe in Eden because they show videos of what it's like inside, and you can kind of earn your way in there. And then there's also the Hive, which is your biopunk society, that believe that you can, you know, humanity can evolve itself in order to kind of ascend and go to the stars and stuff. So in Black Code, you basically go around the city, and you can do the low level kind of stuff just in the main city of Darwin, or you can do your cyberpunk stuff in the grid, or you can, if you wanted to be all kind of like, let's all be robots, and what's the what decisions do we have to make about AI and sentience and that kind of stuff in the Temple, or if you want to be kind of weird inset people, you can go and hang out in the Hive. So I'm trying to kind of future proof it slightly. So any favorite genre that people like doing, you can kind of just go, oh, okay, well, we can set it in one of these different sort of sub genres within the game in order to kind of have some fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sounds really cool. Because I mean, like I say, part of the issue for me has always been that a lot of the sort of cyberpunk games, not just cyberpunk games, like a lot of sort of niche, for want of a better term, sort of sci-fi games, they do have quite a narrow focus where the game works within that focus, but the minute you want to sort of step outside that a little bit or explore something different, the game doesn't really have you covered.
But I think cyberpunk is future proof to some extent, because it isn't those tropes that make it so we kind of know it and love it so well aren't necessarily everyone has to have a cyber arm. There has to be a global power or multiple global powers that are kind of like in oppressing, you know, humanity somewhere. There has to be someone that has more control than the people involved, the protagonists, if you will. There has to be a element of changing yourself and to improve yourself. I think that's definitely part of the genre. And also there has to be something that's going wrong.
Yeah.
It has to be the corporations have too much control. We haven't got enough food. There's a global problem. Either it's the climate, which obviously is now in our focus a little more important, you know, there's some really good, I think actually Hamish's new game is, or Fraser's new game is kind of like a climate punk.
Yeah, I forget the name, but I backed that one. It looked fairly cool, because it's a slight shift, but it's a very interesting shift.
And I think that's, like I say, it's like the evolving the cyberpunk genre. Back in the 80s, it was Wall Street that was the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, corporations were having too much control, governments were kind of falling to pieces, whereas now it turns out the world's being destroyed. Who knew? Yeah. And now we have to go and fix that. And I think something going wrong, a big global thing controlling it, and you guys being the revolutionaries that are using your skills and your enhancements or whatever to try and fight against that. Any section of history can have something that's like that that could be considered cyberpunk.
You see, it kind of goes back to what I was saying before about how, because obviously the genre has been defined currently by its progenitors. So, you know, starting with the Neuromancer and then onward, right? So when we associate cyberpunk, we associate it with certain ideas, but the basic core of a cyberpunk story is absolutely future-proofable. You could keep writing cyberpunk in 1,000 years from now. You could be writing a cyberpunk story, because all you gotta do is have the technology aspect, which can be ever-evolving. But more than that, you have to have the mood and the theme. And if you have that that sort of darker, edgier mood, and everything is sort of cut on that razor's edge, and you know, maybe civilization isn't as good as it could be. Maybe it's fallen completely. You know, maybe you're on a space arc flying to another star system, and the ship's falling down around your ears, but you keep plugging anyway because that's what you got, you know. As long as it has that, as you were saying, Mark, it can be future-proofable. And like you, what you're doing with your game, Mark, it sounds exactly what I was sort of touching on before, which was we need people to be taking the genre in terms of RPGs, tabletop games, and saying, right, this has been done. It's been great. We have plenty of games like that already. What can we do with this genre to say to somebody who's coming into it, who's been playing it for like you 20 years or whatever, and say, hey, I got something that's going to refresh your love of this genre. And I think that's super important, that is not getting done by big enough companies, by good enough people, or getting done at all right now. I mean, I think is what it comes down to. Or like you, Mark, is in development.
Yeah, so, I mean, I agree. I think cyberpunk isn't necessarily the dark future of the 1980s. Cyberpunk is the dark, should be now the dark future of kind of
2080s
millennial, you know, age. And then, yeah, you know, in 10 years time we'll be having this conversation and you'll be talking about how old and boring Black Code was, and then there's another game that's coming out. The next thing. Yeah. But that's good. That's what our industry is all about, and I think that's a very good thing. There's always classics that kind of do the rounds, or perennials like Cthulhu, and I think cyberpunk will become like one of those. Eventually, there'll be a game that just every 10 years or so there'll be a new edition, and they'll kind of reflect it. There is a new cyberpunk official Arthurian cyberpunk game coming out at the end of the year called Cyberpunk Red, which is because obviously now they have the video game licensing stuff happening, and Uncle Mike, bless him, still has the 2020 to 2054, I think. He can still have that for games. And Cyberpunk Red is going to be that, you know, exploring that, which is cool because it means that he can do an update. He doesn't have to go through all the jokes of having giant cell phones and things like that anymore. But I think these things also need to evolve systems. And I think, bless him, they're still using the old Fusion system. So I'm sort of like, yeah, this is great, but I'll probably just use all the background stuff and run it in my own thing.
That's it. I mean, that's kind of like what I was saying earlier about Shadowrun. I absolutely adore the Shadowrun setting. Love it to pieces, but I will not run Shadowrun with its basic system because it's, you know, too much for me. It's just not the kind of way I want to emphasize that setting and that theme. Whereas I could use something like, again, Shadowrun Anarchy is pretty good. I could also just say screw it and use Fate and not have to bother with it, but I don't like to do too much legwork. I just want to focus on the game and the story. But point being is that we need systems that make it, mechanically speaking, accessible.
Yeah.
To people nowadays who, as we said, we've come a long way from being pure simulationist. And obviously, you know, we can have a mix of it. You know, you can have cyberpunk and Shadowrun exist, but at the same time, we need something like that exists on the other side of it too, that says, okay, yeah, you like that, but you don't want to play those mechanics. How's this one? And I don't think we still have enough of that in a lot of the genres, really, across the spectrum. But I mean, cyberpunk's the one we're talking about, so we'll stick with that one, you know?
I mean, to go back to what we were saying about sort of like the mood of cyberpunk, is that possibly one of the reasons why it's difficult to run a good cyberpunk game, because it's difficult to capture that mood, because there's elements of, like we said, like noir and dystopia and various other things that all go together to make that sort of that archetypal cyberpunk feel. However, is part of the reason why it's difficult to run like a good cyberpunk game that it's very difficult to capture a particular mood with consistency in an RPG, particularly if you don't have a system that really reinforces that.
I mean, I think for me, the most challenging thing that I do as a GM, and I primarily GM, is if I have in my head, I never start with, oh, I want to have a particular story in my mind, because that's bollocks. Obviously, you want to make sure that it's the story is emerging from the players as much as it's emerging from what you've created in terms of the setting. But for me, I always want to sit there and be like, okay, what am I trying to evoke? You know, what mood, what theme, what am I trying to get people to feel? Or what, when I'm speaking as a GM, how am I trying to create a feeling? And it's the most challenging aspect of being a GM for any genre, but particularly a complex genre like cyberpunk, where it has so many different elements to it, so many different moods that you need to be going through from moment to moment. I mean, I was reading, like I said, I read Neuromancer in preparation for this call, and in a single page, sometimes in Neuromancer, you go through like 3 or 4 different moods and touching on several different themes that are happening within the setting. And it's you have to be paying attention to see it, but then when you see it, it's like, wow, okay, yeah, like a lot of stuff just got packed into that one page. How do you, as a GM, then convey that? And it's very challenging, and I don't have a great answer to that question. It's one of those things where it's just like, I try to just, it's a feeling. I feel off of it more than I have a method. But maybe Mark or Johannes have a method that they use for their experience.
Well, I was going to say, let's try a bit of an experiment then. Since you're like the cyberpunk daddy, we'll start with you. If you were going to run a, let's say this, obviously hypothetical, if you were sat down with like the four of us and you were like doing like the elevator pitch for like a cyberpunk campaign, let's say, what would your elevator pitch be? How would you try and get across the sort of game that you're trying to run to people?
I think there's definitely elements in a cyberpunk campaign that you need to get across. Like you say, I don't necessarily think the system evokes mood, but the background should evoke the mood. And when you're running a cyberpunk game, there's a couple of things that you definitely need to use. One of them is, at some point, players need to make a decision between taking the money and making the world a little bit better. Then it's not the corporations, it's them. And that is something I think, because they are the revolutionary people that are going around and kind of provoking change, and that's it. They're fighting for a slightly lighter future, or at least trying to, or at least making it better, maybe for selfish reasons. Corporation as a bad guy is great for a role-playing game, because, you know, there's no magic. You don't need undead. You've got people that are just taking people's livelihoods or making things a little bit worse for people, or, you know, doing horrible experiments on them, or doing whatever in order to make a product viable, that kind of thing. And I think putting players in situations where it's their kind of moral compass that's the guiding force about whether they, you know, do it. Because a lot of these cyberpunk games will have the same thing. You get paid to go and do stuff. Most of the time you're getting paid by one corporation to stick it to another corporation, but that isn't making the world better. You're not going out and fighting monsters and getting the gold like in D&D. There's always that little kind of, should we have done that? That's what always happens in my cyberpunk campaigns. At some point the players have to make that decision whether they kind of, you know, do the job or should we wipe the hard drive and see what happens, kind of thing. Not an elevator pitch, but I think those are important elements for a cyberpunk game. The moral ambiguity of the protagonists is one of those Venn diagram points, I think. We're kind of getting back onto that kind of noir detective.
Yeah.
You know. I've got two slugs in me and one of them's a bullet. Yeah.
That's it, man. Okay, so Matthew, if you were going to start running a cyberpunk game of whatever system, we're not talking about specific systems, what elements do you think you would want to focus on to try and sort of get that cyberpunk sort of mood and idea across?
Obviously you've got to have the noir vibe that Whit's been talking about, but I feel like there has to be a unifying sense of rebellion, that the player characters are trying to rebel against the constraints of the setting. So that can be the technology, using the technology as a way of bypassing that, or politically that they don't agree with the kind of treatment of the corporations. That's what brings them together. The unifying force. You'd also want to focus heavily on the relationship of technology between the player characters and the corporations. They're both using these tools to both constrict and sort of free themselves from the kind of constantly big brother eyes of a cyberpunk thing.
I can see that in the chat, Lloyd has mentioned Cyberpunk 2077, and he's saying the way he describes it is like playing detectives in the sort of like the Blade Runner style of background, which I think does appeal to me, because as we've all said, that for me, that noir sort of like detective, that investigative sort of style, it is a big part of it for me. And I think that's certainly one of the elements I'd choose to focus on. You know, I mean, as Whit was saying, often in these games, you're hired by Corporation X to do some espionage or steal something from Corporation Y, and there's the whole investigative sort of like heist style scenarios that lead up to that. And I certainly think if I was going to be running a cyberpunk game, I'd probably focus it around that sort of idea, you know, the investigative sort of style. And I do think there's quite a big market for them. I mean, we've seen like the Dresden Files games. I mean, even things like Call of Cthulhu, like going back, has like a big sort of investigative like vibe to it. And I think part of that's because as players, it's very satisfying to like unravel like part of the mysteries that are going on in a setting or work out what's going on. But I also think as a GM, it can be quite difficult to pull off, because like, if we're talking about like mega corporations, like in a typical cyberpunk setting, the investigative sort of vibe of that only really works if someone has like put in the legwork to design those corporations and have that background there. Because if it's just like me, like Billy bullshitting some stuff and making it all up on the fly, and you're like, oh well, we're going to investigate like this mega corporation, and you can always tell when like people are just entirely making stuff up off the top of their heads, it's not really going to be satisfying as an investigation if you're like, all right, we're going to trail this guy back to his like his pad and see what he's doing. And I'm like, oh yeah, he's doing this. And it's obvious I'm just making it up on the spot because it doesn't sort of link into like a larger sort of overall story. So I think that could be quite challenging if you're a GM to actually like do that. And there's quite a lot of legwork and potentially prep sort of involved in that.
Yeah, the way they kind of sold that in the sprawl is a lot of the content is along the narrative is player generated. So as they're kind of making up their characters, there's a kind of, okay, which corporation did screw you over for this? Or you know, a lot of these stories are kind of self-propelling. And a lot of, I tend to run, in the past, my Cyberpunk campaigns were very long-winded, sort of five-year sandbox type things where the players kind of generate a lot of the content because they, you know, there's an NPC that suddenly, okay, we hate that guy. How do we mess up his corporation kind of stuff? And I think... As Matthew said, the revolutionary aspect is very, very important. You are someone for whatever reason, whether it's for money or for because something bad happened to you, for vengeance or for getting your family back or whatever. There has to be some reason for you to want to stick it to the man.
I mean, I do think that that's absolutely right. That sort of rebellious aspect is very important. And I wonder if that's another aspect of Cyberpunk that's been sort of incorporate into a lot of different games. I mean, certainly the whole sort of like something punk adage is now like everywhere.
Have a lot to say on this. Well, not a lot, but like,
I mean,
that's some bullshit.
That's it. You've got your steampunk, you've got your biopunk, you've got your whatever punk. But
graphic punk.
Yeah, exactly. I certainly remember like when I first encountered cyberpunk, that wasn't such a thing. When I first sort of became aware of cyberpunk, that was the only like punk game I was aware of. Whereas that sort of whole rebellion sort of aspect has been incorporated into a lot of sort of different games now. But actually, Johannes is like champing at the bit to like rally against the tide of like punk games. So go for it, man.
Yeah, it's this is mostly a thing with I think certain computer games, right? I like several people here have said. I think it's very important that if we're calling it cyberpunk, it has to be about people who are sort of on the outside looking in and trying to make a difference either in their own lives, just like barely surviving, or then like generally like, wait a minute, like we could actually like stick it to the man, like Mark said. And well, I do enjoy immensely the Deus Ex computer games, but you're playing a cop. That's not... That's not cyberpunk. You are the man in those games. You are the dude who busts in and shoots people and asks questions later, if ever. Computer games do an absolutely fantastic job of taking all the aesthetic of the cyberpunk world and like dropping you into the role of the oppressor.
Which is like, it's fine. You basically play an end boss of a normal cyberpunk game.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just to chime in on this question, the initial prompt. For me, the most interesting thing that I get out of running or trying to play in a cyberpunk or reading or watching it is, obviously, I agree with everyone what they said before. You know, stick it to the man, do something, you know, big bold. Go out and blaze it in a blaze. But I feel like for me, the more interesting stories are the smaller ones. So it's, you know, you have your street corner and, you know, you have your bar that you go to where you meet your Mr. Johnson, to use the parlance from Shadowrun. And, you know, he's got a job for you at a sort of shitty corporation at the end of the road. And it's, you know, you're just eking it out. And maybe you have, you know, a bone to pick with somebody on your block or someone at the top of the ivory tower. Or maybe you were just trying to get out of the city, you know. So I really like when you can evoke, and this is all driven from the characters, like Mark, you were saying how you're, you know, really it's emergent when you do your campaigns. That's how it should be, because it should be about, hey, if they want to go stick it to the man is always going to be there. But at the end of the day, the man is not necessarily taking the food from their mouth. It's their circumstance. So I really like the antagonist of a cyberpunk game, but this also could apply to any punk game. So Vampire the Masquerade, for example, the gothic punk, it's not really the Camarilla that's really your opponent or the elders, but it's really the circumstances that you find yourself in. You are struggling against the circumstances, and those are just artifacts of your circumstance that are either helping you or hindering you or are neutral to you. And I really find that to be the most interesting thing, because you know, the settings are so rich. You're in this place, and you, if you're doing it right, it feels very thick. And so really, as a player, you really want to be like, okay, yeah, like, how am I going to get myself out of this? And that, I think, is the huge, huge strength of something like Cyberpunk.
That's true, but aren't those situations that they're running against caused by the man in the end?
Oh, well, yeah, but they could be, but the man could be any number of different things, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I think that for me, it's not the rebellion against the man that's the interesting part for me. Like, it's the, how does the rebellion get me out of my circumstance or change my circumstance? Or
I agree. I mean, yeah. They're not going to walk in and, you know, stop Arasaka.
Because the man's always going to be there. It's going to be a different man, though. You know what I mean? So, and that's also another thing that adds to the setting, is that it never ends. It's always somebody else, you know?
So from what you're saying, John, would you say that rather than Cyberpunk needing an excellent villain in the story or the sort of game, the actual villain of Cyberpunk is the setting itself? Like, it's a great villain that comes packaged and ready to go.
That's it.
That should be top.
That's totally it. I mean, because again, you know, Mark's totally right when he says it's the man, but the man is everything. The man is everywhere. The man is ubiquitous. And that's a part of the setting, is it, big bold letters, it should be the man, as next to the setting themes, it's the man, you know, and it's everywhere, and it's everything. And I really like that, because it it's empowering and also makes you feel powerless at the same time. So it always gives you as a character, as a player character, something to rail against and something to exalt. So you can exalt in your victory, only to realize that you're powerless to actually change your fate. And that, I think, is just so powerful for storytelling.
Yeah. And I think those minor victories also, all those little minor victories against such a dark background are more important.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've often sort of heard in, like, games like Call of Cthulhu and stuff like that, where you know that, like, sort of like the great old ones, you're never going to, like, finally defeat them. But because of the fact you know you're not going to be able to do that, in the same way you know you're never going to topple all of these mega corporations, it is sort of liberating in a way, because, as you were saying, John, you can sort of, you can achieve these small victories against them, and it almost frees you from, like, you know you don't have to sort of, like, take down, like, the big end of level boss or whatever it is, but because you know you can't do that, even sort of like throwing a spanner in the works of their plans, or like freeing yourself from whatever, like, yoke they've placed on you, gains more, you get more triumph from it in a way because of that.
Yeah, we caused a minor product recall.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that actually, like, really appeals to me in Cyberpunk. Like, I wholeheartedly embrace the fact that you can't do shit. Like, you're nothing, really. And the end goal is like, well, like, we lost $5 million in the research budget, and it's like, well, find me a new lab somewhere.
But do you know what I find so interesting about that? In a way, taking mechanics out of it, in terms of a narrative approach, Cyberpunk is almost one of the most simulationist experiences you can achieve. Because in life, let's face it, we are all just a single, you know, little cog in a machine, and the world can be quite bleak sometimes. But it's we live for, you know, the next paycheck. We live for that, hey, we're having beers with our bros on the weekend, you know, or hey, I did something to help that one person at my job today, boom, you know. And you amplify that in Cyberpunk to a level where it's like, you are a heroic, powerful being in our world, but in that world, you're just like us, but you're just in a different set of stakes. And I just think that that's juxtapositioning things so amazingly. So that if you want to play a simulationist game, just strip out the mechanics, just focus on the narrative. A Cyberpunk game is a great simulation of life.
Yeah, I mean, that's
the most depressing thing I've ever heard.
No, I was going to say, that is an interesting point. I mean,
sorry.
has Cyberpunk been affected by the fact that, ostensibly, as you sort of, like, look at the day-to-day world, the fact that in some respects, not all respects, obviously, but in some respects, like, the normal day-to-day world has become darker? And it could be the case of, like, you say, well, even if it's not necessarily become darker, we've, due to, like, global media, etc., we're more aware of it now. So maybe, like, when people were more, like, isolated in the past, before sort of global media, in order for an event to have sort of, like, penetrate, like, the mass consciousness, it had to be of a much greater magnitude. Whereas if something, like, essentially, like, traumatic or, like, on the darker side happens now, because we've got like the internet, we've got global communications, everyone becomes aware of it. So we're more conscious of the fact that like there's some bad shit going down in like the real world. So is it a case that obviously we're not in a sort of cyberpunk future, but is it a case that like as the world has maybe, all right, not completely, we're not completely, but is it a case that like as the world has like moved more towards that, it's become more difficult to get the same sort of reaction from people to something like a cyberpunk RPG, because we're maybe a bit more jaded when like people go like, oh, there's these big corporations controlling everyone. Everyone's like, oh, really? No shit.
Yeah, I think actually in some way for me, and I've noticed this in my lifetime, you know, so I'm turning 34 at the end of the month. And in my lifetime, I've noticed this, especially once we got out of the 90s and once the gravy chain became to an end in the early O's and then the mid O's during the crash, you see, thank you, John, you see how our media has changed. Because in the 90s, you had some maybe angsty stuff, and maybe you had some stuff like that, but you didn't have the level of dark stuff that you see nowadays. And the darkness is just sort of a banal covering now on all our, like, it's just, oh, things suck. Yeah, you can't really do anything about it. We're just going to get on with it. And I think in some ways, I think something like cyberpunk is even more important in the face of that banal darkness, because in cyberpunk, yeah, you realize that you're shit, the world is shit, but you're still fighting for that one day that the world is not shit. It's like, if anyone's ever seen the Crystal Exton season of Doctor Who, it's that one episode where everybody lives for that one moment that he lives his, like, that's the, like, his life is like that. He lives for that one moment where he can say something like that. And I think cyberpunk as a genre, and this is just my interpretation of it, of course. I mean, Mark, you can jump in. Johannes, you can jump in and shoot me down if you like. But I think for right now, I think it's very important to have a genre like cyberpunk showing us that, yeah, you can rage against the system all you like. You might not overthrow the system, but that's not the point. It's the raging that is the point.
I agree with everything you said. I'm not going to shoot you down at all. And I think what's happening is we're kind of teenagers, especially, are realizing that technology has given them the tools that they can use to fight against the man or corporations and things like that. The Twitter and YouTube and all these kind of things. And now people don't learn about role-playing games from going to a shop with bearded men anymore. They learn from YouTube.
Yeah.
People now don't go to a rally necessarily, but they go to a YouTube page. They can support each other and they can kind of make these little social groups of people that don't want to, you know, don't like this or want to kind of rail against that or can politicize, you know, there's a certain political thing that they don't. I don't want to turn this into a whole political kind of thing, but if it's something.
But you're totally right, yeah.
And I mean, maybe that's part of the hidden cost. I mean, in this sort of like this technologically aspected future that we're moving towards, what are us old beardy men going to do? How are we going to redefine ourselves in a world where we're not passing on our ancient roleplay wisdom to people and people are just like doing their own thing? Maybe that's the true cost.
That's why we have Twitter and YouTube pages and blogs, and that's why every one of us is like out there trying to yell at in the great stream of the internet, just because we think we have something of value to add, and maybe somebody listens, you know. And that's, at the end of the day, again, it goes back to the theme of the cyberpunk. It's like, you might only get one person to listen to what you said that day, but they might have really took what you wrote or said in your video to heart, and that could help that person, you know, ascend to the next level of the hobby. And it's like that with everything, you know.
You made that sound like we're some fucking E4s on a mountain with our ancient wisdom.
But in 10 years' time, there'll be people talking about how that was the worst thing that ever happened. And that's why cyberpunk reinvents it. Well, there's a line from Cyber Generation that's, my parents were cyberpunks and all they gave me was this lousy future. I'm just like, yeah,
that's
also, I think, like, one of the things to mention about cyberpunk, I think you can't really make it without being very political about stuff, which is also probably not that appealing to like a certain demographic,
or at least subversive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, and as we said before, so anything that's taking place ostensibly in the real world, albeit in cyberpunk, it's like a future version of the world. Whatever side of like the political divide you fall upon, but there's no denying that politics is like a huge part of the modern world. It's been part of the world for like ages. It will be into the future. So I don't think you can avoid bringing that in. But I do think that's right what you said, Johannes, that to some people that's maybe not particularly appealing. You know, some people maybe want to get away from that when they get into role-playing. So a question for you guys is, like, given the fact that we know to a certain extent politics are going to become involved in a game like Cyberpunk, how do you make that appealing and, well, exciting for people to actually like engage within a game?
You don't go all preachy about it, and I think you present the world as it sort of is, quote unquote. So let's take the we're talking about this new game that's coming out before Hack the Planet, which is the like climate fiction, like the world is really fucked up and you're one of the crews that are doing stuff to try and maybe save it or make it better, that sort of thing. Like there's stuff in the background there that you don't need to like shove into people's faces. For example, like, why is the world broken? Question mark. Why are we in this shit? You don't need to like rub that in to their faces. But like you, well, for that game especially, like it's the whole fucking premise of the game. Like someone broke the globe, and
we're not gonna name names. We're not gonna say who done it.
Yeah.
We've got Lloyd in the chat as well, going like, oh, again with this like, whole the real world's like too dark and tragic, guys. It's like, give it a rest.
I mean, I personally love politics.
Me too.
Both in real life, in studying history, and if you study history for any like level, you just see that how politics have always shaped people's lives, daily or otherwise. And so I think the key to it though is to make the politics not a grand sweeping ideological thing. Not like, oh, we're at the conference this week and we're reading the mission statement for our party this year. But it's like, how did this policy that came down last week affect all the augmented people in my community? How did that corporation getting that tax break suddenly affect the economy of this entire area? Stuff like that. I think that's the key, is to not make it something about ideology, but make it about effect.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point.
I think, as well as being the narrator, you should, just like the setting, be morally ambiguous, so you sure don't tell, and you don't really say if this is right or wrong. You just describe
the effect.
The effect.
Yes.
And try and like let it play out as it is, and then let the players decide what that means.
Maybe they love it. Maybe they love the oppression. Maybe these are some jaded up deckers, and they just like, oh, I'm gonna hack the poor people today. You know, I mean, maybe it's an evil, dark tinted cyberpunk game you're running. It doesn't matter.
Sure, how these affect the real lives.
They make the choice. Thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think for myself, I mean, one of the things I always enjoy in like, well, any different role playing game, I mean, to use Vampire again as an example, you can say like, oh, we've got like a high level primogen doing all this like clan politics and whatever. But the real appeal to me is like the sort of like basic like neonate on the streets trying to like get on with their like day to day grind and how they're affected by what's going on, as you were saying. So that's a very good idea that you're not sort of preaching and saying like, yeah, this is right or this is wrong. You're just sort of saying like, this has happened and these are the effects that it has had.
Now deal with it.
Yeah, then you let the players get on with it, and they can. Everyone's capable of forming their own judgment as to whether they think something's good or bad. I mean, if you look at like Star Wars, to give a non-cyberpunk example, you've obviously got like the main story, which is like Empire bad, Rebellion good. That's pretty much what it comes down to. I mean, it's a fairly thinly veiled sort of metaphor. But
they shove it down your throat a bit, and that's the thing
that's it. But
kill a cyberpunk game.
If you run a Star Wars game, literally like within about 15 minutes of like gathering your players, there will be someone who goes like, "Oh, wouldn't it be cool to like play like the Imperials?" So I think there's always going to be some, like you say, some people who want to like vicariously experience the other side of that sort of divide.
In Cyberpunk, everyone wears black. It's the rules.
That's just normal life, man. We're in about.
This has got to work, yeah. Also, I think politics is one of those. You don't have to kind of throw it in people's faces. Part of Cyberpunk, or at least the traditional elements of that sort of kind of those stories, was capitalism growing out of control. And it's not necessarily about kind of whether they're right or wrong, but it's about power imbalance, about how the corporations or the mega corporations or whatever you want to call them have kind of effectively clawed so much power away from the government so that they can do whatever they like. So it's order, or with, you know, it's they're the order, you're the chaos, and it's about kind of getting that imbalance back. So you don't have to kind of put labels on things, you don't have to throw it in people's faces. But I think it wouldn't be a very interesting campaign if you were all corporation, if you were all corporate guys that were trying to kind of meet your quarterly targets. You know,
let's face it, we've all been waiting for spreadsheet the reckoning.
I excel at that kind of thing.
Oh,
I think I could actually get my wife to play an RPG then if they had spreadsheet the reckoning. Okay, I think I could actually get her to play.
That'd be too much like my actual job for me.
Oh yeah, probably.
Okay, so I think we've fairly sort of well covered the subject. Does anyone have anything else they want to bring up about cyberpunk, the genre,
about the punk suffix thing that gets thrown around? I haven't, obviously, because it's so ubiquitous now. you can't keep up with it as a single person, I don't think. But a bunch of those kinda go with the actual like punk oppression struggle vibe thing, and a lot of it doesn't. For example, steampunk. That's Victorian fucking noble crazy scientists oppressing other people. That's a different vibe. But I just wanted to say that I really enjoy the effect that this sort of like let's put punk at the end of everything has, because it translates now into like we're going hard on this one specific detail in a world, and we're trying to milk it for all it's worth and see where we end up. For example, again with the computer games Dishonored and Dishonored 2, like sort of whale oil punk, where everything is about the fucking whales. So you make food out of them, you power everything with the whale oil, and I enjoyed that bit that comes as a result of the whole like, oh, it's punk now.
But BioShock is Rand punk.
BioShock is supposed to be biopunk, so I thought. But you know, it's interesting. I like.
Well, actually.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's totally right in terms of the idea that I love the idea that you can narrow down to a focus point like cyberpunk, Apple, but then, like you were bringing up, Johannes, none of these other, a lot of these other examples aren't actually like punkish. Like if you look at the two words, take the steam, for example, and the punk, right? Well, okay, you got the steam-based technology and that's all it's all going to be about. But the rest of the setting, it tends to be a Victorian era setting. Like, you know, so it's like, where's the punk aspect of it there too? So I think it's an abuse of language with this punk thing. It's like, are we just abusing the word now for market share? Like,
but it's like, it's not necessarily it's almost like cyberpunk, and it's the punk part of cyberpunk, not the punk part of the language that these things kind of use. When they say steampunk, they kind of mean, yeah, but you're a group of people that are kind of rebelling against everybody, and you've got steam.
Right. You're supposedly, at least. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, is it a case as well that as these concepts become more sort of abundant, that it sort of potentially dilutes the original meaning of these concepts? I mean, to use steampunk as an example, you've got sort of what it originally meant, but now it seems to be applied, certainly in some degrees, it seems to be applied to any sort of aesthetic that involves like cogs and like brass fixtures on like everything. And a lot of people would say that, oh yeah, all the machinery in this like game has got like cogs on it, and it's all made out of brass. That steampunk, is it a case as well that like with things like cyberpunk, because of that sort of term has become so common, whether it's the cyber or it's the punk part of it, that it's sort of almost like moved the public consciousness of those terms away from what they originally meant when they were combined?
Well, definitely. I think like because you get all this media and all these games that come out, which are like, yeah, this is biopunk, or this is like paleopunk. Like we're going way back, or with the whale oils, and now we have Frostpunk, which is the name of an actual game, which the idea is really cold, and it's gonna get colder, so you better warm up those things there and oppress your people while doing it.
Oppress everybody, get all the ice and oppress it.
Yeah, but I've got to admit, in a lot of games that use sort of like punk as like a suffix to the name, I don't really see how it applies. It's like if I went like, oh, I'm going to run like a Dark Sun-esque game where like there's not really any technology, everything's made out of like the remains of like dead animals, and it's all furs and like borax. I wouldn't go, oh, this is like a bone punk setting. Because, all right, yeah, okay, you might make all your technology out of bones, but how does that sort of like punk suffix apply? Or if not, just leave it the fuck off. It's like you're talking about like potentially frost punk. If you're like, oh, well, the main thing about the setting is like, damn, it's cold.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, the fuck's that got to do with punk?
Mm-hmm. Especially when your options are like, are you going to be a fascist or a religious fascist? So you're like, where are we now?
I like my fascism, you know, cold and non-religious. So we'll go with just straight up fascist.
Yeah, yeah. I like my fascist bland. Yeah. But like I said, I do enjoy the fact that it breeds these pieces of media which go whole hog on a single idea. Like, what if it was really fucking cold and we were out there? And also, yeah. warm is good. Cold is bad. Yeah, John, vanilla punk is going that's going places.
I said, man, it's all about these oppressive like corporations like saying no, there will only be one flavor of ice cream. We're saving all the other flavors for like the high up executives. It's just plain old vanilla for you people down on the streets.
I'd be a shill for the man in that world then, and be like, vanilla is lovely. Nom nom nom.
Okay, so before we close out, does anyone have anything else they want to bring up about cyberpunk, either the genre for RPGs or for
maybe Mark
fiction?
Wants to give our closing words.
Yeah,
I don't give closing words. There's a couple of things I don't think we haven't really touched on that are pretty much quite influential when it comes to cyberpunk. One of them is music. There's been a whole lot of, when cyberpunk came out, it was the 80s, and we kind of had synthesizers and all that kind of stuff kind of coming in. And then now we've kind of got that sort of, we've had various different levels of computer synthesizer that's come up, and now the cyberpunk aesthetic is kind of like a retro chiptune kind of thing. There's a, yeah, synthwave. There's a whole load of cyberpunk music. Perhaps even more so than there is books and things like that. Dark wave, yeah. I'm a sort of ambient post-rock and thinking now myself. But yeah, there's a lot of music out there which is currently influencing stuff. Also, there was kind of like a weird thing where cyberpunk kind of influenced club culture and clothing, and then the clothing kind of influenced cyberpunk, and then it kind of went back and forth and back and forth. And now the only way you can buy cyberpunk clothing is to pay a fortune for really, really high-end clubbing gear, which is a kind of a real...
That's possibly the most cyberpunk thing ever.
You mean like the sort of the cyber goth fashions and stuff like that?
So I think if you are into cyberpunk or you want to get into cyberpunk, there's a website that I regularly visit called Neon Dystopia, which kind of does reviews of the latest books, video games, music, all sorts of stuff like that. So if you're new to cyberpunk or you want to kind of find the better, more interesting aspects of it, Neon Dystopia is probably the place to go. I have no connection with the men's that do it or the people that do it, but it's definitely a place that I kind of, whenever I get bored and I need to find some cool music to be atmospheric in my cyberpunk games, that's the place where I go.
Oh, that's actually a good shout. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'll look that up and I'll put a link to it down in the description of,
yeah, definitely do that,
this video. And when I edit this down into like the podcast version, I'll stick a link to that in the description. So I think if we're pretty much done there, guys, I'll just thank Whit, Johannes, Matthew and John Drury for joining us for this podcast. Thanks to Lloyd for joining us in the chat. I'm going to stop the stream now. So take care, everybody, and we'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
So that's it for this episode. If you have any questions or suggestions for things you'd like to see in the podcast in future, please either email them to reddicediaries@gmail.com or drop me a voicemail at Anchor. Until I see you next time, whenever you're playing, take care and enjoy yourselves.